Tommy knows, and we're here at the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana, 46581.
Yeah, we know all about that evil stuff. The Shadow knows. Remember that? Well, you'd have to be about as old as me to remember that. That was a radio show back before the one-eyed monster called television. Yeah, it was a radio show, very popular radio show, once a week. I think it was only a half an hour long. Maybe it was an hour. And then it had millions of listeners on the radio. Yeah, so anyhow, that was lots of fun. Well, it is July the 7th, 2015. Tears Day today, all day. We've had rain on and off all day today. And I guess we're going to have rain on and off for a couple, three more days. But it's supposed to be cooling down. It was up into the 80s, but now it's going to get down into the 50s at night. So, whoa, weather change, man, weather change. Well, I had a nice talk with Richard Scutari yesterday evening on the telephone, and he's doing as well as expected inside the maximum security prison. However, they moved up his parole hearing till November, so he's going to get a chance to get out of there maybe in November. I hope he makes it. Otherwise, he's going to end up doing the whole 9 yards of his sentence. Which proves one thing, those big boys, they don't like us Aryans. They don't like us at all. And they use any excuse to keep guys in there for a lot longer than they keep the average nigger in there for murder. Well, I see that transplanted, however she was born in this country, but she's from Southeast Asian parents, I think, Sings or Sikhs or something like that, down there in North Carolina. Well, the white people, they're going to elect these wogs from all over the world. You're going to have to get whatever they dish out. And she wants to dish out taking down your battle flag. Believe me, she wouldn't take it down if it wasn't for the pressure of the good white Christians down there in North Carolina. That's right, boys and girls. If you got anybody to blame, you got to blame yourself. Most people don't understand what's going on here. They think it's these kind of things are one-shot deals. But believe me, the opposition are slowly chiseling away at Aryan history and Aryan culture. This is just the beginning. It's been going on, of course, for quite a while. They'll use flags and they'll use monuments and all that. And as they get more numerous, as they are, they'll replace our culture, our history, with theirs. And of course, that's only right. That's true. I mean, you know, if they take over and become the majority and have the power, then of course it's their prerogative to do whatever the hell they want. And you're just going to have to take it there, Whitey. In the meantime, I think we should start pushing for the outlawing of the Union Jack, the British flag, because the British flag, along with the U.S. flag, were the two flags that really fostered slavery more than any other. Of course, we do know that the blacks enslaved blacks and Arabs enslaved blacks and so forth, but still, it was the Union Jack and then the United States Stars and Stripes that promoted the big-time slavery. You shouldn't have had slavery. That was a fool's option, a weapon against the working class. Slavery never benefited the poor white people or the white working class. And any little bit that they claim that they might have gotten out of slavery, it was taken away by other methods. So anyhow, this slavery thing was a ruling class operation, a capitalist operation. And they should be the ones who pay. But you see how they're foisting it off? They're foisting off the blame on the working class or the soldiers that fought in the Civil War and so forth. Well, what about all those blacks that fought on the side of the South? Don't they have an option of having the stars and bars of their battle flag? I wonder about that. That's going to be an interesting thing. Of course, the average person doesn't even realize that there were tens of thousands of blacks who fought on the side of the South and tens of thousands of blacks who fought on the side of the North. You probably heard, I think it was a white man. I heard it on the news late last night about this guy that was by the river where there was alligators and they had signs all over the place, don't swim in the river. There's alligators here. So he lets out a yell and does a cannonball into the river and the alligator ate him up. And that's how foolish some white people, I wish it wasn't a white person, but I'm pretty sure it was. If you get any more information on that that shows it might be one of the black boys, well, let me know. But that's how foolish some people are with their lives. They'll gamble their lives on almost anything. Well, I wonder how many of you have purchased some of these Burt's Bees product, and you might have wondered, who in the hell is this guy? Well, Bert Shavitz, the reclusive Jewish beekeeper who founded Burt's Bees, just died at 80 years old, as was reported in Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper. So I guess you can say that not all Jews are bankers or pawn shop owners. Yeah, that's true. It might even be a beekeeper. From the looks of the bee population, that looks like it's becoming a lonely occupation, beekeeping. Well, here's a little bit more information that you might be interested in. There's some tantalizingly interesting material in the final report of a committee charged with reviewing the way the Rabbinical Council of America, the country's main Orthodox rabbinical association, deals with conversion. Much comes from a survey of 439 Orthodox converts that provides the first ever statistics about American Orthodox Jew converts. Some comes from a survey of 107 rabbis who sponsor Orthodox conversions. A few other interesting nuggets are buried in the report itself. Well, let's see what they are. Of the RCA's Orthodox converts, 78% are women. 72% are ages 20 to 39. It's interesting that 78% of these Orthodox converts are women because of the very restrictive and anti-female practices of Orthodox Jews. So it seemed like some women like to be pushed around and go by the hole in the sheet. 72% are ages 20 to 39. 45% have a Jewish ancestry. 80% cite spiritual and intellectual search as their reason for converting. In other words, like a lot of other people, Christians too, going from church to church and trying to find out some new thing about the spirituality field and spooks in the sky. About 85% of the converts said the process of immersing naked in a mikveh ritual bath in the presence of three rabbinic witnesses was handled with sufficient modesty. Well, about 57% said the experience was filled with holiness and excitement that left little room for anything else. 29% said it felt like a sanctified moment, but a little uncomfortable. 12% said it was just awkward and uncomfortable, and 2% said they resented it. So whatever that little ritual bath they take. About one quarter of the respondents felt their Beit Din, or conversion court, was lacking in professionalism and left them feeling powerless, subject to unreasonable demands or judged critically. More than a third of the rabbis who sponsored converts in the RCA system are not actually members of the RCA. Sponsoring rabbis in New York City are relatively inexperienced. About half have guided no more than one or two conversion candidates, compared with at least 5 to 10 candidates among most rabbis of other regions. 18% of the sponsoring rabbis said they had at least one conversion candidate rejected by the RCA's rabbinical court when they felt they should have been accepted. If you're black, expect to face racism among Orthodox Jews. That's one of the warnings the review panel recommends sharing with convert candidates of ethnic origin. Sensitivity should be shown as appropriate to matters of ethnic origin, as it may impact the convert's future integration into the Jewish community. In other words, they ain't gonna discriminate against your ass. The most commonly reported cause of frustration and anxiety among conversion candidates was the absence of realistic sense of the timeline for converting. Wow. Converts who were raised as Jews, for example, a Reformed Jew who learned she is not Jewish according to Orthodox law because her mother wasn't Jewish or didn't convert Orthodox, may have faster conversions because they are more familiar with Jewish law, but still must commit to the same strictly Orthodox level of observance as all the other Orthodox converts. Well, my question is this. In Israel, they do not serve in the military, and they do not pay taxes. I wonder what they do here, all these ultra-Orthodox Jews in New York City. Does anyone have information on that? Are they paying taxes? Are they in the army? I don't ever remember running into an Orthodox Jew in the military. But there could be, baby. I love eBay and Amazon. They're cracking down on Confederate flags, but they're leaving the swastikas. Well, maybe that's a good thing. You know, that reminds me on my trip to Israel and being there, what, 8 or 9 days, riding around day after day on this tour bus with a bunch of whacked out Christians. I never heard one of these people in all that time I was there ask, what is the condition of the Palestinians, or anything about the Palestinians. It was like there was no such thing as the Palestinians. That's interesting. Now, if that had been a different situation where the Germans or somebody else had bombed the hell out of a Jewish ghetto and destroyed all the buildings and killed a few thousand people, those Christians would be crawling all over each other, sobbing and crying and screaming and yelling. But not one question or nobody spoke of sympathy for the Palestinians or anything. It was like they didn't exist. Well, from the man who married her grandmother to the man who married her daughter, from working a room full of bar mitzvah guests on behalf of her husband's political career, to headlining major pro-Israel events during her own Hillary Rodham Clinton's journey, has never wandered far from the Jews. Clinton's Jewish encounters have been a natural consequence of her East Coast education. Wait a minute, I thought she was educated in Illinois. Her trajectory in the party, favored by a substantial majority of Jewish Americans, and her embrace of the Jewish narrative of triumphing over adversity and bigotry. She had bigotry? Are you kidding? She's a white girl born, I guess, down there in Arkansas, or that she made her way down there. I don't think that she could have claimed too much bigotry against herself. Sarah Ehrman, whose friendship with the Democratic frontrunner dates back more than four decades, told the Jewish Telegraph Agency that the Clintons, upon arriving in Arkansas in the mid-1970s, quickly established ties with leaders of the state's Jewish community. Quote, "They were smart, educated young couple who had come down to this wonderful little city," unquote, said Ehrman, now 96, referring to Little Rock. The Jews gravitated to them. They could see a couple of greedy politicians in the making, of course. Among her best and most fervent supporters were Jews. The Clintons would attend Cedars in the homes of Jewish friends during the Little Rock years, and in 1988, Bill Clinton, as governor, co-officiated with Rabbi Zeke Palnick of Arkansas's capital city at the Jewish wedding of Richard and Sheila Brofman. Remember the Brofmans? That's the booze fortune up in Canada. The Clintons are both very spiritual. They tend to like to experience different cultures around them, unquote. Well, we know Bill likes to screw Negro women. I guess that's the situation. Sheila Brofman, who traveled the country to campaign for Bill Clinton in 1992 and 1996 and for Hillary Clinton in 2008, plans are underway for a road trip in advance of the 2016 presidential election, she said. Ehrman, a longtime activist with the Democratic Party, that's Democrat Party, really, and with the pro-Israel groups, met Hillary Rodham during the 1972 George McGovern presidential campaign. Quote, "I went down to San Antonio to run South Texas for McGovern," unquote, Ehrman said of the Democratic nominee. Quote, "We were doing voter registration of Mexican Americans. I wanted a lawyer to make sure everything we did was right. I called D.C. I said, you got to send a lawyer down here. The next day, a young woman comes in. She looks 19, all in brown with Coke bottle glasses. She said, I'm Hillary Rodham, the lawyer. And everyone in the room said, we don't want a girl, we want a real lawyer. We immediately bonded as outsiders. 2 years later, Rodham was hired by the U.S. House of Representatives Judiciary Committee to investigate President Nixon's role in the Watergate scandal. So she called Ehrman, asking whether she knew of cheap digs. Ehrman invited her to bunk at her house, and Rodham agreed. After Nixon resigned, the two drove together from Washington, D.C. to Fayetteville, where Bill Clinton was teaching law at the University of Arkansas and where Rodham planned to join him. Quote, all the way down, I would say, are you out of your mind? It's a godforsaken place. You can't get decent food there. What are you going to do? Unquote, recalled Ehrman, speaking to the Jewish Telegraph Agency in her apartment on Embassy Row here. In Fayetteville, Bill Clinton and Hillary Rodham soon befriended another law professor, Mort Gittleman. I wonder what he is. They were both very happy to come to the bar mitzvah of my son Elliot, Gittleman said in an email. These Clintons have been sucking on the kike tit for decades, all their political career. Which was smart if you're that kind of person. Palnick's son Lazar, who entered the bar mitzvah, remembers Hillary Rodham and Bill Clinton working the room for political support at the bar mitzvah. And when his rabbi father would travel to Fayetteville for pastoral work, the teenage Lazar would ride along to help leaflet neighborhoods in support of Clinton, who would go on to lose his 1974 congressional bid to the Republican incumbent. During Hillary Clinton's 2000 U.S. Senate campaign, Paul Frey, Bill Clinton's campaign manager in the 74 race, told a writer that Hillary Rodham, in a heated argument on election night, as it became clear Clinton would be defeated, called Frey a fucking Jew bastard. Both Clintons have vehemently denied the charge and noted that they have fallen out with Frey after the campaign. They also said that they had no idea Frey was 1/8 Jewish. 1/8. I wonder what part of him is... I mean, what 1/8? Is it his hand, or his ear, or maybe his tiny Peter or something like that? How can you be 1/8 Jewish? A year after the loss, the couple were married by a Methodist minister in their Fayetteville living room. The following year, Bill Clinton became the state's attorney general, and 2 years after that, he was elected the governor of Arkansas, which was terrible for the Arkansas people. Quote, I remember them coming for cedar at our house, said Lazar Palnick, now a lawyer for the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania. The Clintons fit very much in with a group of people who cared about feeding the poor, educating people, and making sure everyone gets an opportunity, unquote. What a bunch of bullshit. Hillary Clinton's maternal grandmother, Della, who was divorced, had remarried a Jewish man. Oh. Max Rosenberg, and the presidential hopeful, has credited Rosenberg with encouraging her mother, Dorothy, and her grandmother to reconcile years after Della sent Dorothy at age 8 to live with her strict and forbidding parents. In her first autobiography, Living History, Hillary Clinton recalls that when she was 10, noticing numbers tattooed on the arm of an acquaintance of her father, Hugh Rodham, explained that the Nazi Germans had tattooed his acquaintance when he was a prisoner of war, and told her how the Nazi Germans also tattooed Jews who they murdered en masse. I knew my grandmother's, Della's husband, Max Rosenberg, was Jewish, and I was horrified that someone like him could have been murdered just because of his crazy religion, Clinton wrote in 2003. By the time Bill Clinton was running for president in 1992, the youthful governor and his wife had become favorites among Jewish Democrats. Ehrman described a presidential campaign headquarters buzzing with Jew activists. They were all over the place. Quote, the Jews loved the Clintons so much that they were coming from around the country, she said. If they couldn't come, they would send food. The whole staff would end up in a Jewish room because there were bagels from New York, Danish pastries, Goldenberg's peanut chews, and unquote. The Jewish room, she described, refers to the area where the Jewish activists would congregate. Steve Rabinowitz, a campaign press aide who went on to become a deputy communications director in the White House, recalls 100 people coming to a Yom Kippur breakfast he organized in Little Rock during the campaign. The Jewish sensibility permeated the Clinton White House, where first the couple inaugurated the annual Hanukkah party in 1993, and in part because of the abundance of Jewish staffers. They included communications chief Ann Lewis, senior advisor Rahm Emanuel, and Rabinowitz. There was a Jack Lew, a special assistant to President Clinton, who would go on to become the Treasury Secretary under President Barack Obama, and Ron Klain, Chief of Staff to the President Al Gore, and now Obama's Ebola Czar. Well, looks like there's a lot of Jews in the woodpile here, huh? Quote, I said, you're having a Christmas party. You've got to have a Hanukkah party, unquote. Ehrman recalled, unlike the formal Hanukkah parties inaugurated by President George W. Bush and continued by Obama, these were for staffers and their families, although on occasion children from Washington area Jewish day schools made an appearance. The Clintons' first Israel visit with a church group in 1981 also included the West Bank. Approaching Bill Clinton's presidential run in 1992, they reached out to the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, and AIPAC helped to set up a meeting with Martin Indyk, former staffer who founded the Washington Institute for Near East Policy think tank. The trio hit it off. The meeting ran hours overtime as both Clintons peppered Indyk with questions. According to a source who was present, Indyk went on to become U.S. Ambassador to Israel and Clinton's top Middle East peace negotiator. Bill Clinton's embrace of the Oslo Accords between Israel and Palestine Liberation Organization, initiated by the government of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, further strengthened the couple's ties to national Jewish groups. Hillary Clinton's 8 years in the Senate representing New York cemented those ties. Her pro-Israel advocacy included exposing excitement in Palestinian media and helping to win full membership for the Mogen David Adom in the International Committee of the Red Cross. She also blamed the Palestinians and not the Israelis for the collapse of the 2000 Camp David peace talks and subsequent second intifada. Her advocacy followed the headline-making fallout from an appearance by Hillary Clinton in 1999 at an event with Suha Arafat, the wife of the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. Speaking in Arabic, Suha Arafat accused Israel of poisoning Arab children. Clinton, ostensibly listening to a translation on the headphones, did not react and kissed Suha Arafat after her remarks. Clinton claimed that she did not hear the reference to poisoning. She noted that others in the room missed it, too. The subsequent tabloid attention rattled her, coming just as Clinton was launching her Senate campaign and helped shape the political caution that has come to define her. Quote, I had learned a hard lesson about the hazards of merging my role in an international diplomatic arena with the complexities of local New York politics, she wrote in Living History. After winning the Senate seat in 2000, Clinton repeatedly secured the Tuesday morning slot at the National Jewish Conference for AIPAC and the Jewish Federations of North America, among others, a slot reserved for the most respected pro-Israel figure in Congress. Clinton chose the annual AIPAC conference in 2008 to concede the primaries to Obama. For her 2016 bid, Clinton was has lined up pro-Israel funding powerhouses who helped her fuel her 2008 bid, like entertainment goal Haim Saban, and has added some of Obama's most prominent Jewish bundlers, notably movie executive Jeffrey Katzenberg. Lewis, the former White House communications chief, leads her Jewish outreach. There are other alliances, less noticeable back in the 1990s, that would also be consequential, at least personally. The 1992 election swept into Congress the largest class of Jewish lawmakers ever, 51 of them. Among them was Representative Marjorie Margolis, Democrat, Pennsylvania, who served a single term before being ousted in the Republican takeover of the House in 94. Her opponents raised the issue of Margolis' tie-breaking vote in the 1993 passing Bill Clinton's unpopular tax bill. The Clintons, known for their loyalty to those who fall on their swords for them, campaigned for Margolis in her 2014 congressional bid. She lost in the primaries. Neither Hillary Clinton's office nor Margolis responded to requests for comment. Margolis' son, Mark Mezovinsky, met the Clintons' daughter Chelsea when they were children at a political retreat and fell in love when they met again at Stanford University. At their wedding, co-officiated was Rabbi James Paunet, head rabbi at Yale. Paunet chatted only briefly with Hillary Clinton at the wedding, but got to know her more recently at a memorial for the philanthropist Edgar Braffman, a big-time booze boy. Paunet, in an interview with JTA, said Clinton spoke with sensitivity about Braffman's efforts to make Swiss banks accountable for Holocaust-era Jewish assets. Quote, there's a sense of fundamental connection to the Jewish people and a sense of responsibility to the Jewish people in the world, he said. Paunet described a pre-wedding meeting with the young couple and discussed the huppah. The rabbi advised the couple that any cloth with meaning to the family would serve as a wedding canopy. Mark said, my bar mitzvah talit, that could be used, but I don't know where it is. Paunet recalled, Chelsea said, I know where it is. Oh boy, there you go. That's the whole nine yards of the Jewish takeover in Washington. And on the Republican side, it's almost as bad, maybe worse. The Jews, like any smart card player, blackjack player at Las Vegas, splits up his doubles, goes down and dirty. Yeah, they play both sides of the fence, always. And that article came straight from the pen of the Jews at the Jewish Telegraph Agency, so you got it right from the bar mitzvah's mouth. Yesterday I made the suggestion that to stop the super violence in the Get Black ghetto in Chicago or any other city was to move a Orthodox Jewish family, one family, onto every block in Chicago where the black ghetto exists, and same way in other cities. And that, the reason I said that is because, well, you know I said that, but still, the history of that is when John, my son, and I were in New York City years ago doing a TV show, we decided to go down into the, all the way down into Brooklyn to look at the house of Lord Haw-Haw, where he was born, the British propagandist that worked for the Germans. The house is still there. We saw the house. It's still there. But on the way down, there had been quite a bit of, lately, anxiety between the Jews and the black boys. And I went past one synagogue. We drove past one synagogue, and it was on Saturday, where all these Jews were going to synagogue. And I never saw so many cops in my life. The cops were all around that synagogue, three or four deep. And I didn't see anybody attacking the Jews, but just for appearance's sake or whatever, evidently, I think almost a fraction of the New York City Police Department was all there to protect that synagogue. And a side note, too, every cop car I saw in Brooklyn had four cops in the car. I mean, two in the front and two in the back. And every time I saw cops on the front steps of a house knocking on a door, there were four of them. Anyhow, that's where I got the idea. If they will go so far out of their way to protect Jews, then that would work perfectly with one Jewish Orthodox family in every block in South Chicago. And also, when you tell people that and pass that on, a lot of the dummies are going to say, well, what's that got to do with anything? And that'll give you an opening to talk about the power of the Jews and how fearful the politicians are of offending Jews. Well, here's some interesting news. The heroin death rate in America quadruples in the last decade, and the numbers of women and middle-class addicts are up, too. Number of U.S. heroin users has grown by nearly 300,000 over a decade. Nearly 3 in every 1,000 Americans used heroin in the previous year. Heroin use used more than doubled among whites, leveled off in other groups. Heroin death rate quadrupled over a decade, reaching nearly 8,300 in 2013. Heroin has become a popular, cheap alternative to more opiate prescriptions like Oxycontin, which have become more tightly regulated. Well, you can thank your War Department, your Washington, D.C., Pentagon for that. Because where do you think this heroin's coming from? Well, you probably guessed it. The Middle East, and then mainly Afghanistan, where American troops protect the poppy fields and even help harvest the poppies. So there you go, killing our own people again. And that's your Pentagon, hard at work, destroying your country. In recent surveys, nearly 3 in every 1,000 Americans said they used heroin in the previous year. That's up under 2 per 1,000 about a decade ago, a 62% increase, which translates to the hundreds of thousands more people, the government researchers said. We lost a very good actor. Oscar-winning actor Philip Seymour Hoffman died of a heroin overdose in 2014. In a recent survey, 3 in 1,000 Americans said they have used the drug in the past year. He played in that movie, The Missing Man, or something like that. A very good movie. He was very good. So there you go. Heroin's killing off your actors. Heroin has become a popular alternative to painkillers. It is essentially the same chemical as that in the prescription painkillers, which people are becoming addicted to all over the place. But it costs roughly 5 times less on the street, said CDC Director Dr. Tom Frieden. An increasing number of people are primed for heroin use because they were addicted to an opiate painkiller, Frieden said. The new report found that the people who abused opiate painkillers were 40 times more likely to abuse heroin. The heroin death rate quadrupled over a decade, and so forth and so on. So these people that are pointing their finger at those awful people who take heroin had better stop and look in the mirror and check their medicine cabinet what they're taking, which is just as bad. Oxycontin, all that kind of crap. There for a while, my shoulder and arm were giving me so much pain that I did take some painkillers, but I've never had an addictive personality. I never had a problem with smoking or anything like that, so I wasn't attracted to keep taking that stuff. Well, with 120,000 Ethiopian Negroes brought into Israel, they're having plenty of problems over there. In fact, there's right-wing anti-Negro parties cropping up in Israel. And I see an article here, Ethiopian Israeli or black Israeli parents charge racism at day camp. Well, especially the Orthodox Jews, they tend to be evidently the most racist against the blacks. And now that these Ethiopians are joining up with the military, the IDF, expect to see even more problems. You're going to see a lot more little Nazi Jewish groups crop up. That's going to be interesting. They're already there in Israel. I got an email yesterday from the aide to Katie Couric that said she wanted to do an interview. So I said, well, give me a call. So far, she hasn't called. It'll probably just be one of the same old, when did you stop beating your wife, lone wolfy? Well, evidently, there's a white comedian, Aryan girl, evidently. However, she could be Jewish, for all I know. Her name is Amy Schumer, and she's getting in trouble for being racist, they say. And she happens to tell racist jokes? I don't know. Let's listen to her.
People always think because I'm a white female that I don't deal with racism, and I don't, but I saw that movie Jungle Fever. I get it, you know. I love black and white movies. But no, I totally dealt with racism growing up. I love joking about race. It's like my favorite. I was talking about this the other day. I was hanging out with literally all my black friend. And I remember I was like, Timembe or whatever. Tapestry. It's something wild, you know. And what was she saying? She was like, girl. Like, I won't do some racist impression, so don't worry. But she was like, girl. I mean, we were like mid-double dutch, and I'm just like, stop yelling, we're not at the movies. So many great movies this year. Gone Girl, how good was Gone Girl? Such a good movie. If you didn't see it, it's the story of what one crazed white woman or all Latinas do if you cheat on them. That's a fact. The cast of Fault in Our Stars are here. I mean, nothing works 100% of the time, right? Except Mexicans. I've noticed. That's the one. Boo, right? Boo, Mexicans. I hear you. You guys are preaching to the choir.
Well, that's an interesting events of this new, relatively new comedian, Amy Schumer. I don't know whether she's Jewish or not, but she's a good-looking woman, I'll tell you that. And she's putting it out there that there's going to be a strong support, and there's going to be a strong wanting to kill her type thing, too. So we'll have to wait and see whether she can weather the storm with her jokes about race. Well, in England, a Birmingham University lecturer warns that racism is at a 20-year high on the eve of the 7/7 attacks. Well, it should be going over the top by now in England. England's a very small country with that many non-whites running around, I'm telling you. Well, this is amazing. I just coming back from Israel, and now they found there, right where I was at the Sea of Galilee, the first Imperial Roman legionary camp uncovered near Megiddo. And I was right there. Archaeologists unearthed the remains of a 2,000-year-old Galilee garrison of the 6th Legion, Ferrata, where 5,000 men kept order at the time of the Bar Kokhba Jew Revolt, the only permanent Roman military camp ever discovered in the region. How about that? Too bad I would, if they were digging while I was there, I didn't see them. Well, you, all you Republicans out there should listen to this. To read the findings of pollster Frank Luntz, as published on Sunday in the Times of Israel, one might think that Israel faces dire public opinion times in the U.S. The Times article reported on the Luntz survey summarizes numerous findings by Luntz. The bottom line is that Luntz finds that opinion elites in the Democratic Party are significantly less favorable to Israel than the Republican opinion elites. And guess who's backing that up? All the Christ insanity people in the Republican Party. Quote, 3/4 of the highly educated, high-income, publicly active U.S. Democrats, the so-called opinion elites, believe Israel has too much influence on U.S. foreign policy. Almost half of them consider Israel to be a racist country, and fewer than half of them believe that Israel wants peace with its neighbors. Well, I do. I believe they are racist. I saw quite a bit of that going on over there. But is the panic warranted? Does the Luntz poll reflect a sea change in U.S. opinion about Israel? As of this writing, Luntz has not released the full polling data and cross-tabs, so it's hard to know what other findings and data may paint a different picture. For example, how do independent opinion elites poll on Israel? Equally important, the report does not put these questions and answers in historical perspective. Have Democratic Party opinion elites changed over time, or have they always been more hostile to Israel? And where do they fall on other political issues? Are they disproportionately the more liberal wing of the party? Anecdotally, they've always found liberal Democrats to be less supportive of Israel. By the time one gets to the progressive wing, including the people who staff the newsrooms and left-wing think tanks, less supportive attitudes can become hostility. This is nothing new. It's been part of the landscape as long as I can remember. If there were a sea change, one would expect to see a change in the broad-based national surveys such as Gallup, which has been asking the same questions for decades. What Gallup shows is that the support of Israel among U.S. population is near all-time highs. In polling released on February 2015 after the effects of the 2014 Gaza conflict would have been factored into the public opinion, and when Bibi and Barack dispute was blossoming, Gallup poll was showing overwhelming support for Israel. There you go. Gallup showed that there had been a drop in Democratic support for Israel versus the Palestinians from the prior year, but that support for Israel merely dropped back to historical levels of support seen from 2006 to 2010 time period. Moreover, the support of Israel versus the Palestinians was substantially higher than in the 1990s. Independent voters in the Gallup survey have moved dramatically in favor of Israel, some 20 points higher than in the 1990s. So Gallup surveying does not reflect any broad national turn against Israel, and at worst, a return by Democrats to levels seen just a couple of years earlier. The Pew survey also shows continued strong support for Israel. In a survey released at the end of the 2014 Gaza conflict, Pew showed essentially no change in support for Israel and a drop in support for the Palestinians. When forced to choose sides, the gap in favor of Israel was as high as it had been in years and far higher than in the 1990s, mostly because of the increased support for Israel. Among one group, the gap in support was almost even, liberal Democrats. Unfortunately, Pew did not provide historical data to determine if the gap among liberal Democrats has changed much over time. If Israel was losing support among Democrats, we also would expect it to show up in the political process. But among Democratic lawmakers, there is no visible drop in support for Israel, even if there was consternation over Netanyahu's visit to Congress. This is seen dramatically at the state of the local level, where a unanimous legislature in Illinois passed an anti-boycott legislation, and in Indiana, unanimous legislatures condemned the BDS. In Tennessee, there was only a single legislative vote against the BDS condemnation. These local lawmakers represent small districts, many of which have few Jews or visible pro-Israel groups. Well, I can tell you around here what happens. The newspaper that's the strongest in this area just won't print letters critical of Israel. There's none. So at every level, we see the support for Israel in the U.S. is strong. Obviously, if they won't print criticisms of Israel, we also don't know the attitudes. And of course, every preacher on every platform in every church in this state I live in is preaching pro-Israel stuff 24/7. Plus, it's on TV 24 hours a day. Out of about 17 free channels on TV, 3 or 4 of them are religious and pro-Israel. We also don't know the attitudes of these Democratic opinion elites on other subjects, which might put Israel findings in further perspective. For example, Luntz reports that almost half consider Israel a racist country. They don't care if Israel's racist. They just don't want anybody else to be. If these Democratic opinion elites are anything like those I encounter on campus, the percentage viewing the U.S. as a racist country likely is much higher. That doesn't mean that Luntz is wrong in his polling. It just may be that a historical perspective, Democrats are returning to their norm while Republicans are on a trajectory to almost complete support for Israel as they're pushed by fundamental Christians, mainly Christians. As someone who has been on the front lines of fighting the BDS movement on campuses, my sense is that Israel does have a problem with liberal Democratic opinion elites. That's the result of a generation in which elite campuses that fed opinion-influencing organizations have seen faculty activism and student propaganda activities that present a skewed portrait of the conflict. I've never seen it skewed in any other way but pro-Israel. And that is where I depart from some of Luntz's recommendations as related to the Times report. The problem is education, not messaging. In other words, brainwashing. More. Not mentioning Zionism does not solve the disease. Treat the disease through a generations-long educational effort, and countering negative propaganda against Israel with positive educational experiences, i.e. brainwashing. I'm not saying that Lunt's findings should be ignored, not at all. Take his concerns seriously, but treat this as a generational problem, not a messaging problem for the next election. And that was an article in the Israeli Times, in case you'd like to know. As long as the present people control the news corporations, nothing's going to change. Nothing will change. And that's why it's all going to depend on the collapse of the empire, and initially and so forth, the collapse of the dollar. Once that things like that start happening, things get pretty shook up and things get tossed into the air and see what happens when they come back down to the ground. That's why I support the chaos factor. We need more chaos. Well, all this criticizing of Confederate culture is going to have blowback. It's not going to work. Other critics of the Confederate culture are forgetting what happened in Germany after World War II. The country went to extraordinary lengths to destroy any mention of its Nazi past. The government made it a crime for anyone to use writings, symbols, flags, and slogans from Adolf Hitler's regime. Former WWE wrestler John Bradshaw Layfield escaped prosecution in 2004 after he goose-stepped around the ring and used the Heil Hitler salute because the salute wasn't done for political purposes. Layfield was trying to get heat with the German crowd so they'd cheer his opponent. Germany has done almost everything it can do to make sure that Nazism and the Third Reich are anathema to the country. Yet anti-Semitism is on the rise. American Jewish Committee member Dreiger Berger even asked in the Times of Israel if Germany was safe for Jews to be in. Jewish cemeteries are being desecrated with Nazi symbols in Oldenburg, and one man was given probation for shooting a paintball gun at Jewish gravestones. I-24 News reported 95% of anti-Semitic attacks in Germany were done by neo-Nazi groups. It even surprised the Green Party MP Volker Beck. The German government's solution is multiple failed attempts to ban National Democratic Party of Germany because of its neo-Nazi ties. But the Min Post noted in the 2010 government intervention, it isn't working. This is why getting rid of the Confederate monuments and renaming schools is a bad idea. It's going to make people forget how horrific the Civil War actually was. The monuments to Robert E. Lee and other Confederates in the battlefields of Vicksburg and Gettysburg and Antietam are a main reason why talks of secession these days are met with scorn and derision. The monuments, statues, and school names have to stay up. There's nothing wrong with pulling down the Confederate battle flag from South Carolina and Alabama. Those were put up in a foolish fight against segregation in the 50s and 60s. The same with the old Georgia flag. The battle flag was added to that flag in 1956 by State Democratic Party Chair John Salmon Bell to fight segregation. There's no disputing this. It's a fact. But everything else should stay up, if only as a reminder of the past and how destructive the Civil War was, turning the 1860s into the South seceded and lost the Civil War, Lincoln assassinated, and everything went back to normal, isn't the right way to go. It simplifies the matter and makes us forget why things happened and why a Civil War shouldn't happen again. Well, I agree on that. That's why I like to use reverse psychology. Yeah, tear it all down. Take the monuments away. Get rid of the flags. And it's going to come back and blow up in your face, boys and girls. It's crowd psychology 101. Well, this illegal alien wetback who murdered the woman up in San Francisco, who'd been deported 5 times and had a felony arrest, Well, the San Francisco sheriff, guess what? Ross Mercamias, he's black, I don't know what the hell country he's from, is defending his decision to release this illegal alien, 7 times felon and 5 times deported Francisco Sanchez into the streets of his sanctuary city today after Sanchez shot and killed 33-year-old Kate Stanell while she was on a walk with her father last week. She could very well have been a Jew, and if she is, the sheriff's going to have a hard time. EMS is being accused of being complicit in Stanell's killings after Sanchez admitted in a jailhouse interview that he chose San Francisco due to sanctuary city policies. These policies have been implemented and strongly supported by Mercaramius. This name, he must be some kind of Southeast Asian, but he is very dark-skinned. Quote, California and San Francisco's politicians are culpable for implementing and enforcing policies that resulted in Ms. Stanell's murder. In 2013, the California legislature approved a bill barring police and sheriff's departments across the state from honoring most ICE detainer requests of illegal aliens. That bill was signed into law by, Moonbeam Brown, of course. There he is again. Yep. That law, along with the 2013 city ordinance and 2014 policy implemented by Sheriff Ross Mercurimi, resulted in Sanchez being released from custody in March 2015 after he had been arrested on drug charges. San Francisco refused to honor an ICE detainer request, even though Sanchez has 7 previous felony convictions on his record. The Federation for American Immigration Reform issued a statement yesterday. Well, that guy should have been taken care of a long time ago, the old-fashioned way. But it turns out that Mercurimus has a history of his own. In 2012, he was convicted of a domestic violence charge. The saga began New Year's Eve when Mercurimus, his wife, and their 2-year-old son Theo went out for lunch, court documents said. En route to the restaurant, according to Mercurimus' arrest warrant, Lopez asked if she could visit her family in Venezuela after her husband's January 8 inauguration. In response, Mercurimi began screaming obscenities, accusing Lopez of trying to take Theo away from him. He turned the car around and told his wife she didn't deserve to eat and drove home, the court document said. The fight continued and became louder, and Ross Mercurimi, now get this guy's a Venezuelan, now he's the sheriff of San Francisco. Anyhow, continued to be verbally abusive and physically abusive. The arrest warrant said the incident was reported to involve pushing, pulling, and grabbing. On New Year's Day, court documents said Lopez knocked on her neighbor's door, went inside, and burst into tears. According to the neighbor, Lopez pushed up her sleeve to reveal a large bruise on her right arm and said it happened when Mercurimi grabbed her. The neighbor pulled out a video camera and shot about 55 seconds of footage showing the distraught Lopez. San Francisco Sheriff Ross Mercurimi was sentenced Monday to 3 years of probation in a domestic violence case involving his wife, a former Venezuelan telenovela star. Mercurimi earlier was charged with 3 misdemeanors and could have been sentenced to a year in jail if convicted. Those charges were dropped as part of a plea deal. Well, why didn't they fire the son of a bitch? Mercurimi was also sentenced to 1 day in jail, of which he was given credit for time served. He will be required to complete 100 hours of community service and 52 weeks of domestic violence counseling. In addition, he has to pay fines and fees of nearly $600. After the hearing in a San Francisco courtroom, Mercurimi expressed remorse for his actions. They always do, don't they? So apparently San Francisco residents didn't allow domestic violence to keep them from voting for Macarimi back into office, leading to his decision to allow Sanchez to walk and eventually kill. How about that? How about that, boys and girls? Yeah, how about that? Let me see, there's some more here.
Calls for San Francisco Sheriff to step down. A women's rights group is behind a new petition. CBS 5 reporter Elizabeth Winger is live at City Hall to explain how this may be planting the seeds for a future recall against Sheriff Ross Mercurini. Liz, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, guys. That's right. Well, there's actually that meeting being held right now in the mayor's office over at City Hall. It's about these citywide efforts to stop, to end domestic violence. It's called Peace at Home. It's kind of about putting up billboards, bus ads, talking about putting a stop to this. Folks like the mayor and the district attorney who are actually heading this meeting have been talking a lot recently about curbing Ross Mercurini's power on different domestic violence issues, and some people have actually gone even further than that. Check out this website. This is rossresign.org. It's an online petition calling on the San Francisco sheriff to step down and avoid a really costly recall effort. They want 50,000 signatures. Right before this meeting started, we talked to the president of the Board of Supervisors and the district attorney. They say this is about turning around a bad trend, not the embattled sheriff. We specifically asked George Gascon if he had an opinion about the petition that's currently circulating online.
No, I don't. I really want to concentrate on the public safety piece. I want to concentrate on this campaign, you know, prevention.
Today's event has nothing to do with those efforts. Today's event is to really raise the awareness, particularly for those who may be currently victimized by domestic violence, that help exists to make their situation better.
So this is some video, actually, of a press conference that just kicked off a little while ago. Ross Mercurini, by the way, we tried many different times to contact him or talk to someone from the Sheriff's Department. No one returned our calls as of now. But, of course, Ross Mercurini has spoken many times saying that he has no intention of leaving his position. Frank, back to you.
All right, Elizabeth Winger, live for us at City Hall. Thanks, Liz.
Well, he's a Venezuelan, I guess, came into this country. Himself into politics, and it's interesting how these political parties are currying favor with all these non-whites from outside the country that have only been citizens for just a few years and putting them into power over you, Mr. and Mrs. North and South America, or North, Mr. and Mrs. Wait a minute, to you working class, especially you working class whites. So he's a wife beater. And you can imagine what goes on in his jails, too. And he's the guy that leaves the guy loose that murders the woman. And if she happens to be Jewish, maybe all hell will break loose. We'll see about that. Well, that's about it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day. Boy, the week's going fast. And we'll see if we can dig up some more. We can do some more muckraking, baby. I like to muckrake, and maybe I can offend a few more people out there. Okay, stand by.